a short volume which, to quote him again, was of 46 pages of pure and unsophisticated doctrines. Okay. Well, obviously, as a radical free thinker of his day, Jefferson was in advance of most of the nation. He was also probably the most advanced spokesman for a complete separation of church and state. In Notes in the State of Virginia, he writes, "It's error alone which needs the support of government. Truth can stand by itself. Subject opinion to coercion, whom will you make your inquisitors? Fallible men, men governed by bad passions, by private as well as public reasons. And why subject it to coercion? To produce uniformity? But is uniformity of opinion desirable? No more than a face and stature." And here is the glowing pluralism of Jefferson. And again, I mention this because at the time he's writing these doctrines, there are still established churches after the Revolution. Indeed, in New England, these churches will remain established well into the 19th century. That's not the Jeffersonian tradition. Jefferson had been instrumental in eliminating divinity as a subject at the College of William and Mary. And when he formed the University of Virginia, he likewise assured that there would be no professorship of divinity. Okay. In one sense, however, Jefferson is out of touch with the American religious experience. And that is that Jefferson is extremely optimistic in the belief that rational or natural religion will shortly replace revealed religion in America. He sees this as the triumph of reason over superstition, something which obviously was not correct. As he writes to Adams in 1813, "I very much suspect that if thinking men would have the courage to think for themselves and to speak what they think, it would be found they do not differ in religious opinions as much as is supposed. I remember to have heard Dr. Priestley, a British radical theologian and Unitarian, to say that if all England would candidly express themselves and confess, they would find that Unitarianism was really the religion of all. It is too late in the day for men of sincerity to pretend they believe in the Platonic mysticisms that the three are one and one is three. This constitutes the craft, the power, and the profit of the priests. Sweep away their gossamer fabrics or of factitious religion and they would catch no more flies. We should all, then, like the Quakers, live without an order of priests, moralize for ourselves, follow the oracle of conscience or moral sense, and say nothing about what no man can understand nor therefore believe." Well, I want now to turn to Jefferson's aesthetic views, which, again, are a curious combination. Again, they're naturalistic, just like his religious beliefs are naturalistic, natural religion, natural aesthetics. And for him, nature is a source of beauty and order. But his nature is both classicist and proto-romantic. On the one hand, look at him architecturally. He's a strict disciple of Andreas Palladio's classicism. Andreas Palladio was a great 16th century Italian architect. And he adores Roman ruins while he's in Europe. In fact, he uses the famous Maison Carrée as his model for the Virginia State House. And these pieces of architecture exemplify the ideals of symmetry and geometrical order and harmony. And in fact, what they're doing architecturally is imposing a mathematical rationality on space, a vision of nature as essentially law-like and orderly. On the other hand, Jefferson's literary tastes are decidedly sentimental and proto-romantic. His favorite writer was Lawrence Stern. In fact, he never traveled without a pocketbook version of Stern in his possession. It was like a talisman, a Bible to him. One of his other favorite writings was the great epic of Ossian. It's in fact not a real epic. It's a forgery created in the 18th century, telling the stories of the ancient European peoples before the Roman incursions. And it's extremely romantic and hyperbolically sentimental. When Jefferson learns that it's a fraud, he still embraces it. He still loves it. There's something about the romantic that deeply attracts him. And perhaps the best expression of this is found in Notes on the State of Virginia, in his rhapsodic descriptions of the Virginia topography. They're riddled with the Burkean romantic aesthetic of the beautiful and the sublime. Now, what is the sublime? For Burke, the sublime is an aesthetic experience that creates in us a sense of awe, of terror, and majesty. It draws this majesty, it draws us out of ourselves. It forces us to be overwhelmed by a powerful external experience, by the raw power of nature. Things like shipwrecks and stormy seas.